ray@rte.ie. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, my guest today is the subject of an excellent documentary which premieres at the Galway Film Fla this weekend. It's called Rock and Roll Wizard, and it features interviews with Bob Geldof, Debbie Harry, Donovan, Robert Plant, Imelda May, Michael D. Higgins, yeah, President of Ireland, and more.
More.
And they're all talking about B.P. Fallon. Yeah. So you've worked with everyone from John Lennon to David Bowie to Mark Bolan. The list goes on and on.
I never professionally was involved with Mr. Bowie.
Right.
Because with T-Rex, he was kind of the other camp, you know.
You did kiss him, though.
Well, no, he kissed me, actually. that's what people did at that point in time, yeah. Apparently.
Yeah.
You know, I was sitting there in the room, and this is in Detroit, and I'm just sitting there, no one there, and then out of the shadows comes this chap, you know, and he says, B.P. Fallon. I said, no, I'm B.P. Fallon. Vroom, tongue down the throat. I'm thinking, good Lord. You know, and then later on he played me this record. He said, you like Iggy, don't you? I said, I do, yeah. So he played me this record. I said, this is dreadful. Who mixed this? This is absolutely appalling. I mixed it, he said. And it's one of the great records of all time, Raw Power by Iggy and the Stooges.
What was it called?
Raw Power.
Right, yeah.
You know, and it is it's a weird mix. But actually it doesn't matter because it's incredible.
But you were on his radar all the same.
On
David Bowie's radar, because he knew your name.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know my name, look up the number. Or John Lennon, what's the T-Rex one? John Lennon knows your name and I've seen his.
Right.
You know.
Why did you decide to make the documentary?
Because this chap, Neil Carver, came in. We had an afternoon tea at the Shelburne, as one does. And he said, I'd like to make a documentary about you being a musician and making music. And every few months people would ask me, I would like to do a documentary on you. And I'd always say no. But this chap said, about the music. So I said yes. Now, it was a con, actually. But I hope it's a benign con, because it's just not about my music, but there's me like talking about being in kindergarten. In other words, the life and times of this loony, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, they've worked really hard.
It's a wonderful record of your life, BP.
Yeah, I suppose it is, but there's tons of stuff that isn't there, obviously, you know. But, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, they needed four people to write the Bible, didn't they?
And would you never write a memoir?
I would. I'm actually, although at the end of the movie I say I'm too busy to write a memoir. You shouldn't believe what everyone says, you know. And so it's not impossible that right now one's actually working on that.
Ah, right. And probably the making of the documentary and you having to reflect of your life.
I know, because I don't normally think backwards.
Do you not?
Well, no, I don't. No, I mean, what's happening tomorrow, you know? I mean, it's nice to reflect on things, but I don't reverse into the future.
Yeah.
You know?
You go head on in.
I try to, yeah. Try to.
One of the brilliant things, and he knew what he was doing when he approached you and said to you, this is about BP the musician.
Oh, he knew
what he was doing.
He knew how to get me interested.
Yes,
you know.
Yeah. And you came to making music late in life. It's like you were taking it all in, hanging out with all these people, and then.
Well, people forget, I wasn't just hanging out, you know.
Yes, I know. We're going to talk about that. You were working. Yeah, I know.
Professionally involved,
I know. You say in the documentary that you'd never been as high in your life as
making the record with Jack White.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's incredible. Incredible. Because, he came up to me at a club in New York. Alison Mossart, who's a great friend of mine from The Kills, also Dead Weather, had talked to him about me, apparently. And he said, I'd like you to come down, Jack White, I'd like you to come down to Nashville and make a record. And it happened. It wasn't just rock and roll talk, you know, in the early hours of the morning, everyone talking bollocks, you know. ticket comes, go down there, get my picky taken for the cover of the record. Jack White driving me to the studio. Dolly Parton used to live over there, and that was Hank Williams' house, and they're a fan, you know.
Yeah.
Because you can't make music without being a fan, because otherwise, you know, where do you get it? You know. So I went in there and did a spoken word thingy, which I'd written on the plane, actually, from New York. And when I'd written it, I put it down the side of my chair. So here I am in the studio about to do this magnum opus, and I haven't got it.
Oh, no.
So I winged it. And more or less it came out right.
Yeah.
You know, about fame, you know. Fame number 9, it's called. What is the most valuable thing in the world? The biggest eye-opener. The biggest door-opener. The biggest leg-opener. It's a four-letter word beginning in F. F-A-M-E.
Fame.
Fame.
Yeah.
And then I said I'd like to do a music, a song. So, you know, Jack White saying, has anyone got a slide? And ringing, come round and...
Slide
phone,
guitar, yeah.
The slide, the bottleneck thing.
Oh,
you know,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and ringing up people. And it was very close in the studio. Patrick, the drummer, was right nearer than you are to me. And the bass player, Society Red here, and Jack White literally there. And they're playing, and I've got the headphones on. I think, this is incredible music. And, oh, Jesus. And I just got in time to sing, because I was vibing in on the music and forgot, you know, that I was meant to be the vocalist, you know.
Yeah. So, fame. You were in close proximity to a lot of fame over the years. Have you thought about how it affects people?
Well, it affects people differently, you know. It affects people differently. I was very lucky because I had in my portfolio having been famous in Ireland, you know, as a teenager.
A dry run, so to speak.
Well, I knew what it was. I know it's not exactly global, and no diss to Ireland, because I live here and love it. But so I knew what it was like, you know. And it's weird. Yeah, it's weird. And then I ran away from it, you know, to drive a bread van in London. It's pathetic, really, but I was nervous that people would see me driving a bread van, you know.
And thinking,
oh, he's a... God, how has he fallen?
He's fallen on hard
probably
times.
Probably the most noble job I ever had, actually. It certainly didn't last long.
Yeah.
And it was right by the marquee, so I'd go and see Jimi Hendrix, literally, you know, and then go and pack the bread on the van kind of thing.
I loved seeing all the people talk about you. BP Fallon, rock and roll wizard, and it's the world premiere at the Galway Film Fla this Saturday, July 12th. And we had you in, because we had you in a good while back, before COVID, talking about the soundtrack to your life.
Yes.
And there's bits of that used in the documentary. But you told us then that this song...
Well, you're in the documentary.
Yes, yeah. This song was the one that changed your life. So what I've done is I've taken the one that you mentioned and a few other versions, just
right.
And you can talk us through it after we play it.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, here we go. Well, my baby, she don't stand no cheating, my baby. Well, my baby don't stand no cheating, my baby.
Love me, my baby.
There's loads of versions there, but the first one was Cliff Richard.
Yes, Cliff and the Drifters, recorded live in the EMI Studios.
Yeah.
Better known as Abbey Road. Cliff was the guy who turned me on to rock and roll. And people say, good, you know, it's not exactly Little Richard, is it? Or, you know. But at the beginning, he was funky and rude. And the NME, which is a music paper, he said it was wrong for him to be on television when young people were watching, you know. They said he was obscene.
Yeah.
It wore more eye makeup than Jane Mansfield.
And sort of, it was a gateway. Yeah. Gateway, because then that got you exploring.
It leaded to harder music, yes. Class A, you know. Because when you're in music, you go back. Where did that song come from? And where did it? So My Babe led me to the whole Chess catalogue, you know. There's this guy, Little Walter, who did it, and he's on this label in Chicago called Chess. Who else is on it? Well, there's Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley, and there's also Sonny Boy Williamson, and there's Muddy Waters, and there's Howling Wolf. Treasure trove of music. So then when a few years later, all these beat groups, the Rolling Stones and the Animals, doing these, I knew all the songs already, you know.
They're all blues songs.
Through Cliff.
Yeah, that's mad. Does Cliff Richard know that he changed your life, BP?
No, but somebody's looking for a lot of money to put Move It in the documentary.
Oh, yeah, so you...
They want stupid money.
Yeah.
So I suggested we have a punk rocket and just put it in. The Movie was too expensive, but you get the vibe. Or something on a bit of cardboard, you know.
Yeah.
Someone who will remain nameless suggested that we used another song, which is kind of getting the plane to another direction, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that was a big moment for you when you heard that.
Yeah,
another big moment.
11, I was.
When you interviewed John Lennon and Yoko Ono. So regrettably,
that's completely now.
So that yes, you, I know.
You,
yeah,
you give
yeah.
peace a chance.
Yeah.
That was done in Canada. I went to the Amsterdam, which was the first one. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just arrived on the house.
And what were you at the time? How were you describing yourself?
Chancer, I suppose. You know.
Right, okay.
Because it's all ad lib, everything, you know. I mean, I remember last time telling you that I had no credentials, you know, like exams or, you know,
yeah.
nothing like that. I've got my mouth and my brain. I used to call myself a paid liar representing groups, you know, but I didn't fib that much.
Yeah, but you're understating it completely, Beep, you know, because people wouldn't have hung around with you if you didn't bring something to the table, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
I know that's it's a word that I wouldn't be comfortable saying, but you're very comfortable saying it. You brought a vibe, like you know, there was a definite vibe around you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, and that's and people wanted a bit of it.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Yeah, so you got this interview, and it's the radio reporter's nightmare, and it happened to you.
Yes, I went back to these people I was staying with, the hog farm hippies, you know. Wavy gravy and all of that. Listen to this, John Lennon. Batteries were flat, you know.
I know.
So you either jump out the window or you do what I did, which is I rang up John Lennon, and I said, look, you know, all that stuff we did today, it was very good, wasn't it? Yes, it was very good, but it didn't come out. Can you come around tomorrow? So we did more.
Yeah.
And then the stuff that was at the wrong speed, I met a chap who used to work in the BBC in London, you know, the famous BBC. And I used to go in there and do my radio show for Radio Erin on the QT. So we very speeded the stuff that was at the wrong speed, you know.
Yeah.
And what would happen is I'd leave the tape of the programme at reception, and Terry Wogan would bring it over to here because
right.
he was hustling for a gig over there. But his main lollipop was over here, so he's on the plane. You know?
Nice, bringing your tapes over.
Yeah,
it
was. He was a really...
He was your bag man.
Yeah, he was a cool guy, actually. We used to do a radio show together.
Yeah.
And at one point in time, he showed me how to put on this sort of yellow pan-stick makeup, well, orangey, actually. So all the pop stars used to wear at the time. If you look at pictures of the Beatles, they look orange, you know.
Yeah.
You know, a picture in Fabulous 208 or something.
Which you probably needed because you featured on Top of the Pops twice. And I love this. I love this story. And I watched both of those again.
Wow.
So it's John Lennon. So you obviously developed a relationship after the interview.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't that he'd ring me in the morning and say, you know, I'm confused. What sock should I wear or something?
Right.
But I mean...
But you were...
I mean, he wouldn't have asked me to do it if he didn't think that, to use the word that you used, that I used, that there was a vibe in it.
Yeah, yeah,
you know.
Yeah. So he was on Top of the Pops singing this song.
Yeah.
What year was that, Pete?
1970.
Right.
Phil Spector appeared out of the blue at the session and sort of wheeled himself into it. And he asked John what did he want it to sound like. He said 60s, but now. And it's a great sounding record, you know.
Yeah.
So to embrace what you said, he said, "You're getting up." So I borrowed a tambourine, banged it. Never heard this song in my life. And I was to the left side of John.
On top of the Pops.
On top of the Pops. And his vocal was live. And I'm going like this. And not necessarily rhythmically, just excitement and wow, here we go. Probably or possibly putting him off his, you know.
His game, yeah.
Yeah, so for the, there was another take. And I borrowed a bass guitar and I grabbed a hat out of the audience and worked out some shadow steps with Klaus Voormann, the real bass player, you know. But as soon as the track started, I was, well, you know.
So you were saying earlier on that you weren't just hanging around. So getting on to that, you worked for Apple Records, which was
I Beatles worked for label. Derek Taylor, who was the George and John's guru in many ways. He was, and mine. I mean, I used to watch him on the phone and how he dealt with different people and always be himself, like whether it was Woman's Own or International Times and hippie paper, you know. A very cool guy. And also, if you had nothing to do and you had an hour to spare, his office was kind of like a salon, you know, and you could go there and you knew you'd always get something to drink or something to smoke, you know.
Yeah. And on the smoking, because we've spoken a good few times over the years, we've never talked about the drugs.
Right.
Yeah. So there's a lot of mentions of drugs in the documentary.
Well, there's only one mention, actually, and the whole... Actually...
I'd say there's about 15, to be honest with you.
Who's counting, you know?
But one of the things was, probably tongue-in-cheek, was that you were Paul McCartney's...
I mean, I have nothing to hide, you know.
No, Paul McCartney's weed tester.
Yes. Derek Taylor, I think you know about this, BP, this, you know, would you... Da, da, da. And I've often wondered later, was it a made-up idea? That's such a bonkers idea, just to give me some money, you know.
So did you actually sit in an office smoking weed?
Yeah.
That was then going to go on to Paul McCartney?
I took it very seriously. It took me a few days, you know. And there were all these supplicants in front of me saying, "Oh, this has just come from Africa this afternoon." And a few tugs, you don't know the difference.
That's what I was going to say. I've never taken drugs, but I would imagine as you go on, you're just whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So I've got to ask him next time I see him. I saw him at a wedding a little while ago. We had it. His daughter came up, Stella, who's really nice. You know, "Have you talked to Dad?" I said, "No." He'd give me a nod when he came in, you know.
Yeah.
And she wheeled me over, you know. Very talented.
Stella or Paul?
Both. Both, actually. Yeah. I mean, where Stella McCartney's shop is now, it used to be very, very dodgy with some heavy transvestites, you know. I actually did a photo session of the Pogues there, and Spider fell in love with all the trannies, you know.
Right.
He said, "I don't care what they are, I'd like to deal them with them," you know.
And
third leg boogie, to put
it. We'll come to the Pogues later on, because you say in the documentary that you were the first person in the world to play the Pogues and the first person in the world to play Sinead O'Connor.
Yeah.
So we're going to get to those. But before that, and still in the 70s...
Right.
Good luck, John.
Oh, yeah.
Mark Bolan and T-Rex.
Oh, brilliant. One of the newspapers reviewed it as Mental Guru.
Oh, yeah.
And Mark said, "Oh, they've written about you, man, you know."
You're his mental guru.
Yeah.
And that was a bit of your function, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, part of it is as simple as playing the right records to people, you know. And with Mark, we'd always listen to rock and roll records. Maybe the Incredible String Band every now and again, or Doctor Strange, Is He Strange, or Fairport Convention or something. But mainly it was mainline rock and roll, you know.
Yeah.
Little Richard, Jerry Lewis, Gene Vincent, da, da, da. And of course, that got him sort of, you know. I said, you should have a bass player, man. No, I don't need a bass player. And I got June, his wife, then wife, involved as well. And she's going, Mark, you should have a bass player. And then one night, Oxford, Tony Visconti, the producer, got up and played bass. Beep, I think I should get a bass player. What do you think? Yeah, I think it's a good idea. What about a drummer, man? You know.
Yeah. And what about the attire, the clothing? Because that was glam rock, wasn't it? And he wasn't into that initially.
No. I mean, glam rock is just a title because it's rock and roll. You know, whether you've got, you know, eye makeup or not, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, Elvis used to wear eye makeup down south. Little Richard, come on, you know, the king and the queen of rock and roll, self-titled.
Because
what was happening?
You seem to be an expert on eye makeup.
Well, it's no harm.
No harm, right? You know. Okay. No. Right.
Because what was happening, Ray, was that there was mainly blues groups, you know, in denim, and some of them were really good, like Peter Green, Fleetwood Mac. They were incredible, actually. But by and large, they were grey, you know, and we needed something sexy and under the belt, you know, bit of a tease. And it worked.
Yeah.
You know, a dream came true. And then I left at the peak of it because I felt I'd done what I set out to do now.
And you moved on?
Yeah, I'd moved on.
There was a mention of Deep Purple, which I won't get into, and then there was...
Oh, yes.
Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, Led Zeppelin. Oh, great track.
Yeah.
It would be quite good if you played Muddy Waters' I Need Love. It's the same song.
Oh, is it right? Yeah.
Small Faces did a great version of it. And in fact, Steve Marriott from the Small Faces was, I think, the first person that Jimmy asked to be in this group he was forming.
Right. So again, you were asked again to do what you did with T-Rex.
Yeah, I guess.
So you got a name around town. For this skill.
You do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
You do. I mean, it wasn't all, you know, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, you know, we had David Enthoven from EG Management came downstairs before this meeting with these three guys, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, gave me a black bomber, which is an upper, but it's got wobble in as well, so you're not too tense, you know. And we're sitting there, it's Thursday night and it's Top of the Pops and Free are number one, all right now.
Yeah, yeah.
And Keith Emerson leans over and says, well, we don't want that shit, do we? So I'm thinking, I don't want this shit. And then they complain, he said he doesn't wear socks, you know, how can he represent us?
Yeah.
So it was a mutual dislike.
So you parted ways with Emerson, Lake
and Palmer. Because the music was bollocks, you know.
Fanfare for the common man. And then, of course, you always had an eye across the Irish Sea to Ireland.
Oh. Great sound.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Right.
Great sound.
Like, I can't believe that... They contacted you or whatever, and you picked up the phone to Mark Bolan, who had a TV show.
Yes.
And said, "They're this group of lads from Dublin."
Yeah.
Is that how it went?
I said, I'm working with these guys, you know, the Boomtown Rats. And Mark said, will they be big? And I said, yes. He said, all right, they're on then, you know. And so that was the first time they're on television. It kind of opened the door for them, really.
You're doing?
Well, Mark being very kind, you know.
Yeah. Bob, what do you think about what Bob says about you in the documentary?
I'm not sure what bit you're talking about.
No, but just, you know, he's sort of like, he's talking about your music.
He's not saying it's brilliant, put it that way.
Yeah.
But that's fine.
Yeah.
You know.
It's not everybody's cup of tea, I suppose.
No, I mean, different people have different things. And fair play to him for saying it, you know, rather than everything.
There's an honesty about him always, isn't there?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I don't mind that at all. You know, I mean, we're very dear friends. Have been for ages, you know. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Do you see
this is like living inside a groovy jukebox, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's your life, BB. This is your life.
Oh, gosh.
This is your life.
I have been on This Is Your Life.
Yeah, have you?
Yeah, it was Geldof's one.
Oh,
yeah.
Was it? Right, there you go.
And when they introduced me, I was eating an apple, so I walked on with the apple, and people were very distraught. They thought that was awfully bad form, you know.
Did you eat an apple when you were introduced?
Eating an apple. I mean, you know, ask Eva about these things. She'll tell you.
So... did you travel to Carlow to see the Pogues for the first time?
I did.
Yeah.
Frank Murray was their manager. Frank was a friend of mine since 60s Dublin Beat Group days, you know, and he worked very closely with Phil Innitt. And he said he's managing this band and Elvis Costello might produce their next record. So off I chugged to Carlow. And what I took away with me, but they were a dance band. And the audience, you know, everyone's leaping up and down and having a whale of a time and spiders banging a beer tray on his head. It was rough and rocking and fantastic. But then when I sat down with the record and listened to the music and the lyrics of this guy who I remember as Shane O'Hooligan in the Pump days when he used to wear a Union jacket.
He was in the Nipple Erectors.
He was in the Nipple Erectors and he famously had his ear bit off at a Clash gig.
Did he?
His ear's just fine, you know.
That's why you have to write a book.
You know.
Go on.
You'd sit there and think, God, that guy wrote... Da, da, da. I mean, so talented, you know, and one of the most... amazing songwriters ever, you know, not just Irish, ever.
Ever, yes. Yeah, you know. And then the late and great and lovely Sinead.
Madam.
Get sad.
I'm just nearly crying here. You know?
Yeah.
What an incredible person. Incredible person. You know, she put truth before the career. She said what she thought, sometimes clumsily, but what she was talking about has been proven correct.
Oh, sure, look, they're still talking about it on Liveline today.
I know, it's still going being researched.
Yeah,
you know, it was only Black Rock for a while, you know, now it's every school, not only ones run
Well, not every school, but a good few of schools around the country. And she, you know, she was talking about it when nobody wanted to talk about it. So she went to the Grammys, she sang Mandinka.
At the Grammys,
yes. Yes, yeah.
And also... Grammys in Los Angeles.
Yeah. Did you go with her?
I ended up in the Grammys, yeah. And Public Enemy, who...
the rap band.
...are one of the most important groups ever come out of America, were sort of regarded as not important, and they were like down the list getting an award in among people getting an award for writing a good album cover or something, you know. So Sinead had the Public Enemy logo put on her head.
Cut into her hair?
Painted sort
of. Yeah, oh, right, okay.
The pictures I took in the documentary
been
put on. So Public Enemy were on the big part of the Grammys. They were on Sinead's head.
Brilliant.
One of the best things was that I saw Al Green, you know, the Reverend Al Green. And so I went up to him, I said, would you be kind enough to bless me and my friend, Sinead?
Right.
And he came over. And you know how backstage, no one gives a toss if you're Frank Sinatra or anything, you know. The whole place went silent, you know. And he's doing all this thing. You know. And then they all start talking again, you know.
Yeah.
But it was...
the Reverend Al Green blesses B.P. Fallon and Sinead O'Connor.
I've been blessed by Solomon Burke several times.
Solomon Burke, brilliant.
King of Rock and Soul.
Yeah, yeah.
I went to his church in Los Angeles and he made me stand up, you know. Got a friend here from Ireland, stand up. I was delighted, but I was sort of embarrassed as well, you know.
Solomon Burke, Reverend Al Green. I saw Al Green in Vicar Street.
It was incredible, wasn't it?
Ah.
Voice of God coming through, you know.
Yeah.
I've gone to his church in Memphis. It's fantastic. And we could go on about Al Green forever, actually.
Yeah. So we're clocking them up now. So you were a PR man, a mental guru, photographer, and your pictures are brilliant because people feel so relaxed in your company that you
Thank
get
you.
Access. That's the, you know, you, you get, I suppose, portraits that other people wouldn't get. A DJ as well, of course. Yeah. You're on 2FM, you mentioned that already. And you DJed on the Zoo TV tour for U2.
With U2.
Yeah.
Who were incredibly good to me. You know, really.
Was that the Trabant
tour? It was a mirrored covered open top Trabant. And I would appear with my Elvis cloak made by Patsy Dennehy, the wonderful Patsy Dennehy, on the back, I think, Elvis with a crown of thorns, you know.
Yeah.
And jump into me little Trabant. And I had a microphone as well, you know. So you could talk to the people.
So you were the warm-up act, I suppose.
I was foreplay, really.
Yeah. A fluffer.
Oh, God, I've got to put that in my CV.
And Adam's in the documentary.
Yeah.
He talks lovingly about you. And
he's a very nice man.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
And he's had his odd wobble, you know.
He has, yeah. You know there's a magnolia named after him.
Flower?
Down in Congreve Gardens, down in Waterford.
Wow, because his gardens are beautiful.
Spectacular garden.
You know, beautiful.
And then only in the last 5 or 6 years, you started recording yourself. We mentioned that already. And never been as high in my life.
Yes.
So is there any regret about not doing it earlier?
No.
No?
No. Because I was enjoying what I was doing.
Yeah.
And it wasn't as if Nyla Nine, you know, wrote a piece very kindly, and he said that, you know, finally one of my dreams was happened.
Realized.
Make a record, realized. But it was never my dream.
Right.
You know, I was happy doing what I was happy, and then because of Jack White, it changed everything, you know. Terry is twanging away, Mr. White. Aaron Lee Tajan riff.
Elvis Presley, I believe in Jerry Lee. I believe in Dr. Winston.
That's John Lennon.
I believe in you and me. I believe in Lewis Carroll.
That's great.
Some people ask me, was that my response to the John Lennon song God? You know, I don't believe in...
Yes.
No,
it wasn't. BP's a legend, an interesting guy, love his voice, great storyteller, a fan. Real tonic, hope he never changes. I was living in London when Jimi Hendrix was there, saw him walking down the King's Road, Chelsea, one day, Ray. What a sight to behold, a riot of colour, walking work of art. In recent times, I met Donovan, who was a really cool and pleasant guy, bumped into him in Milan Airport.
Wow.
Told me he was returning from a gig in Italy. So that's Thomas there. He's met
Thomas. He's been vibing ferociously well.
Yeah, and BP Fallon. BP did a radio series on RTE around 1982 called "Beep Goes the Beatles," and of course, you interviewed George Harrison as part of that.
No, George was a separate.
Well, he was a separate one. Separate
yeah, but it was nice doing it because we knew each other, you know.
Yeah.
From Apple.
Yeah.
I mean, the friend of mine just bought out a book, Willie Christie. He's a photographer, and he writes about. When I invited him to be the photographer when I was writing about the Stones, you know. And it just came to me that it was normal for me to see George Harrison coming in and out, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But I had a friend came round, dear friend, Simon Stable, God bless him, and he got what I call Beatled. He couldn't handle it. It was too much.
Right.
There was a Beatle, so he had to go, you know.
Right. That lovely word, Tugel.
Tugel.
What does it mean? Long may you tugel,
said
to me the last...
Yeah, long may you keep on keeping on,
right, keep
basically.
On keeping on. Well, long may you tugel, BP Fallon.
Thank you.
And BP Fallon, Rock and Roll Wizard, is premiering this Saturday as part of the Galway Film Fla. Always a pleasure, BP Fallon. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ray. God bless you.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.